This is the Detection at Scale podcast, a new show designed to help security practitioners succeed at managing and responding to threats at a modern cloud scale. As the volume of data increases and the attack surface expands, it's never been more important to stay ahead of the curve. Each episode will feature interviews with leading security practitioners, thought leaders, and company founders who are building the next generation of security tools. I'm your host, Jack Naglieri, founder and CEO of Panther Labs. Now let's get into today's show. All right, welcome back to another episode of Detection at Scale. My name is Jack Naglieri, and today I'm here with Anton Chuvakin, security advisor for the Office of the CISO at Google Cloud, and Timothy Peacock, senior product manager at Google. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us. It's fun.
This is, although Anton and I have hosted 120 episodes of our podcast, this is actually my first time being a guest
on really?
The podcast. Yes.
Well, I'm honored that. I'm honored that this can be your first where you're appearing as a guest. That's awesome.
I'm honored to be here.
Does it mean you're moving up to the B list? C list?
No, definitely not. I remain on the F list.
You're on the F list.
It's where I've been since school. It's great.
So my intro question for you both is, why did you get into cybersecurity and why do you choose to stay in cybersecurity?
Oh, it's a good question. Anton, you want to go first?
You know, lots of people ask the first, but almost nobody asks the second part, the staying part. So I think my story in the cybersecurity industry is can be discovered kind of by searching for my old blogs or something. But why do I stay is an actually really good question. So I want to kind of dwell on this. I've met enough people with burnout, with people who think that cyber is hopeless and they need to go back to a gardening or some name random occupation, you know, feeding sharks, whatever. So to me, I have a particular anchor thought that makes me stay. And this is the classic Dan Gear quote from a good number of years ago when he said that cybersecurity is probably the most intellectually stimulating or challenging profession on the planet. And to me, I am just like latched onto this. And I make jokes sometimes that I used to do quantum physics and I thought that's too simple. So I needed something more intellectually stimulating. I never actually seriously thought that. But to me, the fun part, the ever-changing nature of security, the fun part, the challenges is kind of what keeps me here. I think it's just too exciting to leave.
It is certainly exciting and dynamic, and it's never the same day twice. That for me is a big part of what keeps me. And I also, for me, think it feels like the place where I can, with my skills, do the most good. You know, like if I was slinging ads, I don't think I would feel as fulfilled about what my time was being put towards. I kind of fell into security accidentally. I was actually a political science major. And so for all the poli sci majors out there, it is actually possible to become a PM at Google with that degree. But I was looking at post 20th century conflict, and I had two research projects I could have pursued one summer, one on the South China Sea and one on patriotic hackers. And I was like, well, either way, I get to think about pirates. But I went with the patriotic hackers angle, ended up at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., and then came out to the Valley for personal reasons and fell into the industry and been here ever since.
I think it's an important point that you made around contributing the best way that you know how to.
Yeah.
Like finding that balance and starting with poli-sci, and I guess Anton, similarly, starting in another field, getting into security. How did that transition really happen?
Oh, for political science, it's the same thing. You spend all day thinking about incentives and adversaries and how you create and maintain power. The same thing.
Interesting.
Same exact mindset.
So your answer here is much more profound. I think that my transition from physics was never kind of a conscious, thoughtful thing. It's basically, I dealt with computers for my physics programs and some of the computers were hacked. And then I was helping some other people with computers because I like computers and their computers are also hacked. So I started saying, there's something fun going on. And it's kind of like a physics to computers to not just, you know, optimizing storage or some such thing, but actually intrusions, dealing with them. This kind of was my first encounter with the world. And I was helping somebody at a small ISP. And of course, back at the time, small ISPs were kind of a havens for all sorts of interesting activity.
The thing you said, Anton, that was really interesting to me was you stay in cyber because it's the most intellectually challenging problem on the planet. Why is that? Because I can name like three other things where I'd be like, I feel like that's harder, like launching a rocket into space.
feels pretty
good. No, that's easy. That's just physics.
No, because it doesn't involve humans and their ill will. So in that sense, Rocket is definitely easier. I mean, you sort of know what to do. If it involves physics, it may be hard to do. It may be hard engineering, but you roughly speaking know what to do. But it involves both technology and humans. Then in many cases, you don't know what to do. And then Tim may point out that if it just involves humans, forget technology, then you already don't know what to do. But ultimately, technology makes it an ever-changing domain. Humans make it fun. So to me, this is kind of like a tech plus humans together in one barrel is what makes it exciting. And I think it's hard to beat.
I think the better than comparing it to putting a rocket into space is more like getting a rocket with people in it to survive the journey to somewhere else.
Hmm.
Because to me, what makes cyber hard is as defenders, we're securing systems that we aren't the owners of. And we're securing the intersection of systems that didn't consider those intersections when they were built or couldn't even begin to consider those intersections. And you have human beings who want to mess with you. Like, if you compare cyber to, say, storage,
mm-hmm.
sure, you can pack more bits onto a disk. And there's interesting problems there. But at the end of the day, the bits aren't trying to mess with you. You don't have an adversary who's financially motivated or state motivated to do ill. And so to me, it's an interesting technology domain. It's an intersection of technology domain. And it's one with an active adversary who is very motivated to hurt you.
Yeah, that's probably the best way to think about it. And again, not a Venn diagram, but like there's a technology domain that changes, that brings new things. It gets built, it gets misused, it gets, and then the human ill will and the creative humans at that.
Yeah.
So well, to me, this is... Humans. Yes, very motivated, creative humans who are out to get you and the technology domain. So to me, this is, it's hard to match, frankly. I can't think of another similar domain.
Probably working in like crime scenes and stuff.
Yeah.
It's similar. That's actually the analogy I always use. It's like you're playing crime scene investigator when you're doing response. You're like, okay, what happened? Who got in? What did they do? Like, what do we know? What do we not know? How do we build the story and the narrative? Because when you're dealing with humans, there's always so many unknowns mm-hmm. and understanding motivation is very difficult. You have to look at action to understand motivation. And this is actually true for like managing. This is like leadership.
Yeah.
There's a big intersection actually. And having the consistency and understanding what you need to do to motivate people to do something. And yeah, being on the other end of that is really interesting as a responder and having to tell a story. And I think sometimes we get a little too lost in the data and not so much zooming out enough to think about like humans on the other side. But the question I would have is how many organizations actually need to deal with active adversaries versus just like doing due diligence? Because, you know, being at Google and the big Fortune 500s, for sure, you are constantly attacked. You have people trying to get your IP, trying to steal your money because you're a big target. But everyone in the world needs good security. So mm-hmm. what's the range of experience, you think?
Wait. So you were asking something about dealing with the active adversary, but that to me is a little, like there's a gap between dealing with active adversaries in your environment and just focus on hygiene. Mm-hmm. Like there's a range of things that you may not need to deal with, kind of like a trying to overcome the adversary who is in your environment, but you may be in an area where you don't just need hygiene. You may need maybe some form of detection and response. You may need to have an MDR partner. Mm-hmm. I feel like these are two extremes that are very far. So mm-hmm. most of the world probably is in this big fat middle where you need some DNR, you need some DNR capabilities, maybe rented from somebody, aka outsourced, maybe built internally and then handed to somebody for help, rather than truly focusing on things like attribution and which particular threat actor, what's their intent, what are they doing here? So to me, this is like that's a very broad range.
I guess it's fair to say that not every organization on the planet has to worry about sophisticated people putting radioactive isotopes in their cup of tea. But I often use the phrase background radiation of the internet to describe kind of the just omnipresent threats you get exposed to being connected to the internet. You know, somebody's out there crawling every bit of IP space looking for that vulnerability in WordPress, whatever. But it's important to remember that that doesn't just emerge from nature. know, we use this word virus to describe some of this, but it's not as if it's a virus that just springs into existence by that's how chemistry works. Yep. There's still a person operating that at the end of the day. And so I don't know if it makes sense to really distinguish the Fortune 500s of the world who worry about an active adversary versus the rest of the people who worry about background radiation. That radiation comes from someplace.
I mean, it's a really good physics astronomy analogy. I agree. Yeah. I like that. It almost it made me very briefly feel regretful I didn't make it up. But of course, I mean, to me, the sub challenge to this challenge is people who think that they just need hygiene and they don't need any DNR. These people do make me nervous, because when they say that we will just build harder preventative controls, and for us, given that the top tier threat actors are not out to get us, let's put the supply chain questions of you being an HVAC contractor for Target aside. If the top tier actors aren't to get you, is hygiene enough? And I've been a pretty adamant critic of that view. Like, I would say, no, you do need some kind of a junior DNR, a beginner's DNR, but it may be heavily outsourced. And in my Gartner days, we started writing a paper focused on, like, how do you start with detection response if you have flat out nothing? And some of my colleagues looked at me and said, no, Anton, don't write this paper. You already have a paper on outsourcing security to MSSP. That's a paper. You really just need, if you want to start, don't start. Go find an MDR provider who would take your money, shove money in their hands, and you're done. And that view also kind of made me nervous, because ultimately, if you know nothing whatsoever about detection, how would you even tell a good MDR from a really, 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 really bad one?
Is that problem different than any other problem a small business faces outsourcing expertise? Like, I don't understand, if I'm running a pet shop in my hometown, whether my accountant is good or not.
Actually, it is different. It is different. And I think there was some kind of paper many years ago by some economist who also did cybersecurity. I mean, market for lemons, right?
Yeah.
That in security, you don't actually have robust accepted criteria for judging good from bad.
But I mean, there's like very macro things that you can gauge on. So for example, did you get breached or not? That's like a pretty basic one. But
it's late, too late.
Going back to what we were just saying, though, you might be one of those companies that is just never targeted. So you pay the money. And I've said this before, a lot of what we do is like insurance. You know, it's a thing you pay for that's kind of invisible most of the time. And then if you get in an accident, you're covered versus if you're not.
But you're not covered, though. So that's why I don't hate it. I used to hate the analogy security like insurance in terms of payments, because it's an insurer. And let's leave cyber insurance aside, because we're not
talking about
cyber insurance. It's like security as insurance to me is a worrisome analogy, because security never actually pays you back once you're breached. It's an insurance that you pay for, and then something bad happens, and then you're screwed.
Yeah, it's a little bit more like you're bracing for the impact. So it's more of like you're building the airbags in the car, and like you're kind of getting ready, and you're building the systems that can prevent the accident, right? Like you're building the autonomy and the, you know, preparation for it. But yeah, I think I agree with you. In reality, it's not really great to use the insurance analogy, but I think about it a lot just in terms of like the macro parts of it. If you're saying, how are you gauging the success? It's like, did you get breached or not? It's like, okay, well, if we didn't get breached, maybe it's working. But I think it's a really good point. I mean, I guess the question I'd ask is, if the thesis of like how our end users supposed to gauge if MDRs are good, does this mean that security tooling just needs to get more obviously educational? Like, should we be telling people like, hey, this is what good means, and this is how you get to good in a SIM, for example? Is that the responsibility of the SIM vendors, or is it more of the responsibility of the MDRs? Because it could be either.
So let me try to answer. So ultimately, if you are, let's assume that you are using a partner of some sort, MSSP, MDR, who then uses a tool? So you will have a kind of a tri-way split of responsibility, right? Mm-hmm. So for example, the fact that platform stays up is with a vendor. If it's a SaaS vendor, then definitely with a vendor. Whether you react on the alerts is probably with a client, but whether you get useful alerts is probably with an MDR provider. But why is this a good question, though? It's sort of like somewhat clear who is responsible for what. People do misinterpret this, I admit. But it's still relatively clear. It's not a big mystery in the universe, right?
Well, I guess what I'm trying to say is, at what point do we train people on what good is? Because there is a point in which you have to take responsibility for DNR internally. You get too big, either the MDR is not effective anymore, which is what you see. But when you're early days and you're a two-person startup and you're like, I want to go raise venture capital and I want to go solve this really important problem in probably the AI space right now, but I don't know anything about security. Like, hey, I'm just going to go call so-and-so and they're going to cover me. And then there hits an inflection point where you grow and you're like, okay, now I need to make this part of my own like internal team. And this happens a lot in company building. I mean, I can attest, right? Like I've spent the last 5 years building a company and I started with outsourcing my accountants and then I hired a head of finance and then they actually did it right. So we want to hope that it's not like that. But I think the reality is anytime you outsource something, you're going to get like a mixed bag of results because one, you don't know what good is. And then two, it's often not tailored enough for your business. So then it's like, how do we bridge that gap with technology? Is it a gap we need to bridge? Or do we just keep having people work on the problem manually, right? Because you could say like, well, why don't we just make the technology better? Why don't we use things like AI to like know what good is, which is hard, right? Obviously. But it's like, where should that balance be? Like the question I was actually going to ask is like, how do you advise people to go from zero to one?
I actually think that's the wrong question. And I think it gets back to understanding yourself being the first part of securing yourself. Not everybody needs to get to one. One is different for every organization based on, well, how likely it is that somebody's motivated to put polonium in their cup of tea, right? Like if you're a, let's take an example, somebody manufacturing cat food, you're probably not that interesting of a target. If on the other hand, you're an AI startup trying to build consumer purchasing or health predictions, you're probably very interesting for the kind of data you're going to have. And so I guess the advice that I would give people most importantly for how do I get from zero to one is actually figure out, do you need one? Do you need five? Do you need 100? And based on that, what your endpoint is going to be very different.
To me, zero to one, I mean, we already established, at least that is my belief, that nobody truly needs a zero. Nobody needs absolutely no DNR of any kind. So to me, I sometimes joke about Chromebooks and SaaS. Like if you are Chromebooks and SaaS, people would assume that then maybe 97% of your security problems are solved. And not all of them, for sure. Identity, yes. And there may be some really top tier threat actor who can, you know, break into a Chromebook. I don't know. I doubt that. But the point is that you would still need some kind of identity focused detection, even in this extreme scenario of like Chromebooks and SaaS, when most of your security is taken care of magically, essentially. So let's say that we kind of mostly established nobody needs a zero. To me, if you wake me up at 3 a.m. and say, Anton, how do I start with detection? If I have absolutely nothing whatsoever, apart from some vague, sleepy comments about you need to learn what it's about, it would probably involve a partner of some sort. It would probably be some form of MDR. And yes, you would need to build up your skills of judging MDR providers rather than detection skills, because ultimately, and they're connected, but your actual purpose is judging MDR good from bad, or at least okay from bad.
Okay, but the same signals you rely on to judge anybody from good to bad, in that scenario, you would use to judge MDR from good from bad. You're not going to, as an independent person, figure out which MDRs are good or not. You're going to figure out whether they have like a website that doesn't suck and a sales guy who can put sentences together.
And that, you know, either obviously I'm biased, the nature of my past employment, I would look at analysts, I would look at what consultants that I trust think of them. And I would, if I am truly picking my first MDR, maybe I wouldn't necessarily look at analysts, funny aside.
Because, not everybody has a Gartner subscription, it turns out.
Exactly right. That's one. And two is I may not need a generic answer. I might need an answer from me. Yep. And MDR business specifically is very regionalized. So if I am, like if you call, actually somebody did call Gartner and asked, what are the right MDRs to use if you are a healthcare provider in Northern Belgium? And probably nobody knew.
We should have gone to the Flanders booth to find that one out.
Exactly. So like nobody, like that stuff is too regionalized. And sometimes there is no answer that you can just get from an analyst. But ultimately, you would learn to judge security outsourcing partners and then you'd pick one. That's, to me, that's probably zero to one for most people.
The thing I've learned is no one wants to start from scratch, like truly, right? Even when you install any security tool, you want the batteries included. I can almost think of no scenario where that's not true. So I really think it just comes down to then how do you judge the output? And that's where something like MDR comes into play, where it's like, we're going to do our best to judge this and make the right calls and handle incidents for you. And it's a reason why they've been really successful in the early days. But I think regardless, that mentality carries through even to vendors. Because if you go install any SIM, they're going to have plugins and they're going to have out-of-the-box detections and all these different things or rules, right? So it's definitely not a journey anyone wants to do. And especially given the complexity, right? We're saying like it's very hard to track humans and put behaviors together because it's a very non-binary like field to operate in. Mm-hmm. That's what makes it very hard. So I like the answer though. Tim, I actually really loved your scale of saying, well, you have to understand like is 0 to 1 is right for you versus 0 to 5, 10, et cetera, and understanding your threat models and, you know, having that right intuition. That's super, super important. I'm wondering, you know, how this is going to play out in the next few years, given we're making so many amazing breakthroughs in AI and generative learning and all these different things. Like the thing I wanted to ask you guys is, what do you think is really going to happen where with DNR, what are the three most applicable use cases for AI that you see, at least in today's capabilities? And obviously things are rapidly developing, but just curious on your perspective, because there's a lot of answers to this. And I think it goes really well after the question of talking about like, well, how do you get started, right?
But wouldn't it be, I mean, both of us would probably give you a very self-serving answers, right? Like it would be very, like, you would never, I mean, I would almost never, but in this case, I kind of would. Because looking at our own announcements using the specially trained security LLMs and other stuff, I was thinking about that very question, like what would be the three use cases? And sometimes people bring up things that are highlighted by others as top use cases, and I don't really like them. And maybe let me start there so that my answer is not just towing the party line. So remember our discussion about some vendor who wanted to build remediation playbooks using Gen AI?
Yeah.
And to me, this was very tempting, but ultimately it is to me a high risk use case, because imagine that you don't have expertise and you ask, hey, AI, build me a playbook to remediate this issue I'm having. And AI says, sure, here. And then because you don't have an understanding, you just run it. And then what? Your universe explodes? Like you don't have a skill to judge it, right? That is why you are asking AI. But ultimately, then you don't have any skills to judge the output. So to me, this is probably not a tier one, kind of like a priority one use case.
Is that, Anton, really all that different than asking the compiler to write assembly for you?
You actually have reasons to trust the compiler.
And there's reasons to trust the AI.
What are the reasons to trust the AI?
You bought it from a vendor you trust, and hundreds of thousands of other companies use it every day.
But that's not the case today.
But it will be in 5 years.
In 5 years, that use case is perfectly legit. I'm not talking about 5 years. I'm talking about today. Sure. It's not a... I think Jack asked about the kind of three immediate use cases, not 2030. I think that explaining things that are complicated is a critical use case. And to me, I almost felt like it's a little silly, but then I was wrong. I think it actually is very not silly. And what changed my mind is the looking at the VT virus total code insight, right? If you load up some really bizarre obfuscated script you found online, and the thing would tell you what it does and probably who wrote it. Well, not who, but like what group and what it does and why it's there. Then blows my mind. But it's not really a generative use case. It's a use case. It's kind of the summarization use case, a little bit classifying use case. And to me, this is really cool. Of course, Tim would say, how can you trust that the AI is not making stuff up? But the stakes are lower in this case compared to here's code, run it without any understanding. So to me, I would still think of summarizing, explaining complexity, classifying things, and then generate. I am kind of, that's where I am. I am a little afraid of generating stuff that would then blow up the universe. Detection code, sure. At worst, you get what? False positives?
Fine. Blood the sock, that happens every day.
It happens every day anyway, yeah. Am I too rambly? Do you want a crisper answer? Maybe Tim will give a crisper answer.
No, I'm very excited about use cases around using AI about AI. I think there's this very scary thing to me. I was thinking about wedding invitations and how people still pay for a calligrapher to write them by hand. And you can tell looking at the ink, how it flows, that it was done by hand and how the letters join up and all that. And you can't simulate it. Like, you can't fake this. We used to have that for the written word, regardless if I was written, that it came from a human being. And we're about to not have that. And so I'm really interested in almost the like Deckard AI, where we can create AI that reliably detects AI generated content. And, you know, spoiler alert, I'm a firm believer that Deckard is also a replicant and is himself, although being a Blade Runner, is a replicant and doesn't know it. So I don't know. I think that to me is one of the most like society level interesting things we'll see happen with AI. Because otherwise, what does it look like where it's a world of AI generating content for AI to consume for other AI to consume? Like, it,
yeah, well,
very scary to make.
There are so many memes of people who use something like Bard to write long, beautiful emails, and then the other side is using some AI to summarize emails. Like, I'm sorry, but it's funny, but it's life. I think that if you want to write a one-liner, I'd rather write a one-liner. If you want a long, beautiful email, perhaps the intent is not to feed it to the summarizer on the other end. We're going off topic, Jack. Fix it. Bring it
back.
Sorry,
Jack.
So
you have to reel us back in. We're good hosts, not good guests.
If the whole value of an LLM is contextualization, summarization, finding patterns, why wouldn't we just put all of our security logs into it? Because I haven't really heard of people doing that yet. And
the technical reason is token input limits today.
Yes, for sure.
Yeah, but I did see a 100,000 token input limit LLM the other day. There's a path there. I think there will be other approaches to having LLMs consume large data sets. And I do think that's a very interesting topic of how do we, both for the explanation use case, as well as the anomaly detection use case, as well as the anomaly detection explanation use case. So like, to me, those are kind of three separate things. Like, one is, what does Anton normally do with his account?
Yeah.
One is, here's all the logs from my org, find the one that's weird. And the third is, hey, this thing is weird, why?
Yeah.
And the weird why is the really tricky one today. Like, if you go look at the SOC stuffed by good people, but maybe not like the best in the industry, this whole head scratching about why is a major use of their time. And again, you probably see across your clients now, your tool may produce uniquely easy to triage events, right? But I'm sure clients still struggle with like, why did it happen? And what does it mean for me in my environment? And if LLM can help there, even a little bit, that's pretty huge. And again, if you recall the RSA summaries post, I kind of said that to me, this type of AI is a micro game changer. It would game change SOC life, but it wouldn't like, hey, fix my security kind of macro.
But I do think, going back a question, what you just described, Anton, has the potential to shift the watermark for where you pick up an MDR versus drop your MDR.
Mm. Yes.
Interesting.
And I've seen people replace a really bad MDR with a SOAR a good number of years ago. And initially it struck me as illogical, but then I realized that if your MDR is really bad and all they do is kind of like add context to events and send the events back to you, then SOAR can do that for free. Well,
not
for
free, but cost.
Initial capital with no OPEX.
You
pay a little bit and then maybe. So you're right. LLM can push this even further to squeeze out. LLM to me is a mediocrity killer because it can create mediocrity much better. So if you are a mediocre, I'm going to go on a rant. Sorry. Please stop me. I mean, it's...
No, let me make a different point about MDRs, because I think we could take LLMs as MDR killer, but we could also say MDRs will change the cost model for MDRs.
Yeah.
Like,
it's not I didn't say it's a killer. It's a killer for a mediocre or worse MDRs.
Okay, fine. But you can imagine how an LLM would allow an MDR to remove a layer of cost from their structure.
Yes.
But you can also imagine how in the long run, that makes it harder to fill the next level of your operating stack.
Yes, that's right. That was always the SOAR brought up this kind of spectrum of this problem a little bit. If you're the leader who like is obsessed about, I'm going to automate L1 tasks, then what would give birth to your level two analysts? Where would they come from? Magic? An alternative universe? Like where would they land from?
I don't know.
So I want to shift gears slightly. So we're talking about data scale slightly in the context of you need a lot of context to do good security. And that's probably a big reason why security is very hard. It's not just, hey, here's a bunch of data, tell me the weird thing, because the weird thing might not actually be bad. Like the weird thing could be like, oh, I woke up early and I logged in 2 hours before. Yep. Did that generate an alert that wakes someone up? No. Right? It's the sequence of things, and then it's building the case. And having a system that does that really well is probably the magic of really where DNR needs to shine, is contextualization, correlation, building the case, intelligent ways of scoring things, et cetera, right? So when we were talking about 0 to 1, things in the early days are very simple of a company, right? You don't really have a lot to secure. But as we, you know, get to like a Fortune 500 scale, there's just so much data. And the question I want to ask you guys is, do you believe that SIEMs need to actually support this like planetary scale idea anymore? Because things are going to continuously grow forever. So is it actually scalable to try to force everybody to build this big pipe for SIEM versus an alternative? Because I know Chronicle's big claim initially was like planetary scale, Google scale, like get as much as you need into it. But I'm starting to see with people being more conscious on cost, that story is starting to change a little bit. And I'm curious on your perspectives.
The product I built first at Google was originally intended to work so that you didn't have to store your data in something hot and searchable, except for when you had to go do an investigation. And the hope was that we could develop a streaming system of sufficient scale and complexity and capability that the old model of store it all on disk, God will know his own. Mm-hmm. You run out of disks. Like literally there are manufacturing constraints that start to emerge on the supply of hard drives very quickly at cloud scale. And so I think that the SIEM market and maybe even the SIEM mentality has a date, and we're not yet grappling with that.
That's fair. And some people are bringing up the decentralized as the answer, but ultimately, as I was trying to explain to somebody recently, if you want the traditional model of retaining logs according to this broad policy you have, somebody somewhere will pay for a hard drive. It may be you, it may be some partner, it may be Google, it may be somebody else, but there's no way to not have somebody pay for a hard drive if you are subscribing to a traditional I have to retain model. But it's almost like, how do you break that model? If somebody says, PCI says, hey, keep logs for a year. You're going to keep logs for a year. Are you going to down scope? But that's the question that pretty much every SIEM vendor since the birth of SIEM struggled with. I want to collect security events. I want to leave the rest. And then suddenly the discussion goes. And then you are in the collect everything business. So I don't think we quite have an answer. And I think Tim is right that the model would have to break at some point.
It's going to.
I think that right now, I am a little bit enamored with this whole decentralized approach, but ultimately decentralized means somebody somewhere is still paying for hard drives. To me, decentralized is you found some kind of loser who would pay for your hard drives without knowing they're doing this, and they're doing it anyway.
That's terrible.
Well, I think we need to get better at understanding what the data is, because as you say, like, oh, PCI or whatever insert compliance framework here tells me I need to store my data for 7 years. I think in the past we've looked at that as like, okay, cool, turn it all on. We'll pay the $50 million or whatever we need because we're a Fortune 500 company, versus actually going in and saying like, well, what is actually important in that data? Because you don't need everything. You only need the security relevant things, but also you don't know what you don't know. So as an insurance policy, I think we've paid the extra cost to have it to our disposal, but we haven't been thoughtful enough about what goes into that pipe. So I think there's not a great answer yet. And the thing with cloud, though, that's very apparent is that data is just everywhere. And you need some place to store it. But then the question becomes, like, what's the scale and what's the slider that you're going to pay for? Because in this economy where everyone is very, very conscious of spend, it's not really a great game plan to be like, hey, send us everything. Because I don't think the market is really down for that anymore.
No, it's not.
But then it's like, oh yeah, go ahead, Anton.
I think that it's somewhere close to breaking, but I don't think it's quite broken yet, because you can still squeeze out, you can still use lower tier storage, you can still do I mean, people going crazy with data lakes, you probably saw. And to me, this is like incredibly so 2012, because when people discovered some security teams discovered Hadoop, and they're like, holy cow, we're going to make a data lake out of it. And then, well, somebody's paying for hard drives, right? Somebody's still paying for hard drives, whether they pay for hard drives for a commercial product, open source product, cloud provider. It's like, I don't think we are at the breaking point, but I think we would at some point get to the breaking point, but there would be a detour to decentralize, if you like, because people say, well, I'm not going to centralize my data. I'm just going to keep it wherever it is. And then suddenly you're in the world of 1998 when you, before syslog, I mean, when logs are somewhere on the machines and you have to go look for them. And then you build this query engine that knows where to look and goes looks, but the data ain't there. Like, there would be a detour. But ultimately, the model would have to break, right? That have every log for every circumstance probably wouldn't work. But this is very philosophical, and I think observability movement is trying to say, oh, you don't have enough logs. Let us give you stuff from inside the app. Because, of course, we always wanted to see what's inside the app, and we have this a lot of extra log storage lying around. So how are we going to use it? We're going to just get inside the app telemetry, roll it in there, right?
Yeah, it's interesting. There's a lot of people taking new approaches, which uses the distributed approach or decentralized approach, as you said. But again, that has its own challenges too. And sometimes it doesn't really work where you actually just need the data yourself, or you do want it centralized. So it's going to be really interesting to see how it develops. And I'm looking forward to seeing what happens, how certain vendors shine out and certain patterns really become the norm in this world where things need to be a bit cheaper.
I'm really keen to see which approaches deliver good security outcomes.
Yes.
Which sadly is a slightly different approach or a different question than which vendors will win.
For sure. And I heard a lot of people talking about this idea of kind of what you said in the beginning, which is you just go out and get the data when you need it. But that can be dangerous because then you're outsourcing it, and then some dev on the infra team is like, oh, I phased it out because it was costing a lot of money. And you're like, oh, well, now we can't see what was taken, you know, 3 months ago.
Yeah.
And that sucks.
Which is why improving time to detection is so important.
Yeah.
It ends up being a must, because ultimately, if you're doing it in service of detecting threats, it better work for that purpose, right? It's not like you're doing it just to make your neighborhood auditor happy or something, like, or a PCI assessor. So it is, I mean, I've noticed how a lot of the compliance discussion is still there in the background, but ultimately it doesn't drive the conversation. I mean, many RSAs ago, I was in the expo floor and I looked around and I'm like, I don't hear compliance. Like, the deafening noise about compliance just isn't there. And it's there, but it's not like there as deafening noise. Like, AI to me, or ransomware, or a bunch of other stuff is just louder. But ultimately, these use cases still exist, and people still think, maybe not 7 years, that they need to retain data, they need to have stuff available in case there's an incident, or in case there's some other form of validation and verification. So I don't know. I think decentralized would make a lot of auditors probably really angry, because you have absolutely no assurance that the logs really are there.
Yeah, your chain of custody isn't established ahead of time.
You have neither chain nor custody. You have hope and best effort.
As we always say, hope is not a strategy.
Well, on that note,
we have something optimistic in the end.
On that note, hope is not a strategy. Yeah, but you do have to visualize the world you want to create, right? That's a little bit of hope.
A little bit.
Hope and faith. Well, cool. I really, really enjoyed this conversation, guys. I want to conclude with asking your wisdom on three pieces of practical advice that people can take away on improving their cloud security today. And, you know, there's probably 2 hours of answer in that question, but I would challenge you to distill it down to the three things that are most top of mind for you based on some of the stuff we talked about today, or just some of the trends that you're noticing.
Yeah, well, listeners, the good news is that Jack actually pre-flighted this question with us. So I've been sitting here for the entire duration of the conversation thinking about what good advice is here. So the best thing I could come up with is three things. The first is for cloud security people to make good friends. It's a very daunting field, and I don't think many people can figure it out alone. But if you make good friends, either internal to your organization or externally, it helps to know you're not alone in doing it. the second piece of advice is exactly what I said before about the 0 to 1 question, is to know yourself. And the third thing is to practice. The last thing you want to be doing is collecting the logs for the first time because you think there's an adversary.
Okay. So because you asked about cloud security specifically, I will go on a very, very short rant about cloud security. One of my recent obsessions has been the configuration and misconfiguration and all this other stuff about mistakes. And some of you who follow me on Twitter probably recall me asking, how come CSPM vendors started 10 years ago and cloud misconfiguration are still the main issue for problems? And I've got a lot of very fun responses, but ultimately at this RSA, Tim and me went through a bunch of cloud security vendor booths and we asked why people give them money, not in so many doors, but ultimately they all told us people give us money because we are good at finding cloud misconfigurations. I mean, the story varies, yeah, but ultimately that's kind of where it goes. And to me, this is an area where, sure, we have shared fate. We have situations when Google Cloud helps clients more by more actively engaging with them. But ultimately, I feel like we need something more interesting to solve this and something more dramatic, something that maybe Google or similar companies can do rather than just have a faster scan or a better integration with CI/CD or better developer education. Or I feel like it is somewhat embarrassing that cloud misconfiguration are the main thing for cloud security issues. And of course, my former employer, Gartner, would highlight that most cloud breaches are customers' fault, but ultimately these lines are connected. They're most cloud breaches are customers' fault because it is normally seen that it's customer responsibility to configure stuff securely. So it creates kind of a weird circle of customer is responsible. They go and try to configure something securely. They fail. They go by CSPM or similar vendors. CSPM tells them they have problems. They try to fix the problems. They fail. They get breached. It's their fault. And then they get motivated to try it again and they do it again and it doesn't change. So to me, I think I wish we and others would do more with shared fate. We are doing more to really break this vicious circle of cloud misconfigurations. To me, this is a little philosophical, but it's also practical, you know, develop and use technology for that purpose. I mean, it is doable because we've seen people do it, but that to me is kind of the area.
At first, Anton, I was going to argue with you about, you know, this whole customer's fault thing. And then it just made me really depressed that I came to Google 5 years ago because I got sold on this vision of, well, we can do it different this time. Cloud is an opportunity to do it different. And as we were running through that, it really broke my heart that we haven't done better yet. So thank you for breaking my heart this morning. I appreciate that.
Okay. So I remember we had this discussion about technology, like OS vendor. Why go to cloud vendor to fix cloud issues? You don't go to OS vendor to fix security issues. Well, you sort of do. You do sometimes, but ultimately it hasn't really worked for OS. And so, but for the cloud, we believe that ultimately cloud providers would quote unquote fix cloud. I think that it is in our hands and I think we will actually get it done. I'm not sure about others, but we probably will. It probably would take more time. I'm sorry, I'm an optimist today. I apologize. And I know it's not in my persona and all that, but I just feel like Google will make a big difference.
Don't want to see you as a pessimist.
Well, I really appreciate the time, guys. It was great to hear your perspectives, and I'm glad we finally made the time to get this on the books. It was an honor to have you on the show, and really looking forward to talking with you guys again soon.
Perfect.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Detection at Scale podcast brought to you by Panther Labs. For access to the latest episodes, please visit our website at www.runpanther.io/podcast. And for those interested in running Panther, head to our website, runpanther.io, to sign up for a free trial. You'll get a dedicated instance with the ability to analyze your security logs in real time at any scale powered by Detections as Code and sending into a very robust security data lake. Our goal is to make detection and response easy, scalable, and fast for you, the practitioner. Thanks. See you again next time.